podcast for all your running needs.
Ned, he was a terminally happy guy. And Ned, he ate a moldy pumpkin pie. And Ned, he thought that he just couldn't die. Then Ned, he laughed so hard it made me cry.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Run, Run, Live podcast. The podcast for runners, wannabe runners and mid-packers of all shapes and sizes who just want to strap on their favorite pair of shoes and get out there. This is not Chris, your host. This is Raymond from the Geeks in Running Shoes podcast. I'm the guest announcer this week. When you are done listening to the Run, Run, Live podcast, come visit me at geeksinrunningshoes.com, where Jason and I, two self-proclaimed geeks, talk about our training, comment on and share what we have learned on this very, very interesting path we call endurance running. So, wherever and whenever this episode finds you, I hope you are doing great, and I hope you are getting your run in today. I know I just did. Are you ready to have some fun? Come on, let's go for a run.
I think any time anyone travels, walks in another person's shoes, sees how other people live, gets a larger view of the world, a deeper understanding of history, by virtue of seeing it, understands in a visceral way what people eat, how they live, how hard they work, whether it's next door or next country or other side of the world, that can only be a good thing. Travel and mobility, it's the greatest privilege of the world, and I think to whatever extent one can accrue wisdom or acquire wisdom, you know, where you've been and what you've seen and who you've met are helpful. I am in a really ridiculously luxurious position in that I was rewarded right away for being myself. Whoever I was in 2000 when Kitchen Confidential broke through, I never for a moment deluded myself that this was an identity I would have to hang on to. I understood from the beginning, you know, that I am not going to end up like Hunter Thompson. For me, it will always be about a quality of life. I will always find a way to stay interested. I'll do my best to not become a cartoon of myself, and if I do, I'll be the first to point the finger and laugh. I just never felt that obligation to keep wearing the leather jacket, always be seen with a cigarette, you know, live up to any kind of persona or expectation. And in fact, the whole tracking of the show has been, we try very hard to undermine whatever worked last. We try very hard to undermine it or deconstruct it or, you know, do the opposite.
Hello and welcome to the Jet Lag Podcast, where we discuss the mind-numbing process of trying to convince your body and brain that it's okay to get up and go to work at 1 o'clock in the morning. But it's okay because the sun is up and it's really 7 o'clock in the morning and time for breakfast. Think about how strange that is for our dinosaur brains and our animal bodies. The whole concept of jet lag and time shifting, it's like magic. Where in the genetic algorithms of the last few billion years were we unceremoniously plucked up, stuffed into a metal tube, and dropped off on the other side of the planet a couple hours later? Our evolution has had no way to prepare for this. This is a phenomenon of only a few decades ago. And you know what that means? That means this is the Run, Run, Live podcast, and we have a great show for you today. I speak with a young man named Drew who decided to run across the United States for injured veterans. Nice dude, good perspective on life, and some good stories to tell. Fairly entertaining. I've had a fairly weird week of travel and training. Had to jump on a big old jet airliner Saturday night for a flight to Amsterdam and a train down to Eindhoven for Monday morning's meetings. And I did manage to get a couple good runs and rides in before I left. I've been getting lost in the new trails I discovered with Buddy. I put a couple of videos up on my YouTube feed to show you what they look like, which you can also get through my site at runrunlive.com. One night during the week last week, I got home late, and I went out with Buddy at sundown. And we went into the trails, which is pretty late because it's the summer solstice up here in our hemisphere. So we're talking 8, 9 o'clock I went out with Buddy for an hour and a half run. Buddy doesn't mind. He can see in the dark. I was supposed to go for an hour and 20 minutes, but ended up staying out for almost 2 hours. Because on the way back, I somehow got off the trail and found myself totally lost in the woods in the dark. Of course, I have my headlamp and my GPS watch, so there's really nowhere I can go where I live that would be more than a mile or so from the nearest road. But there's a lot of swamps and dense bush that are rather uncomfortable to struggle around in. I'd have to set the chance of actual mortal danger at way less than 1%. Most of the time I just tell Buddy to find the new trail, and I follow his white tail through the woods. The problem is that sometimes he's not really interested in finding the trail and thinks that cutting through a swamp would be a grand idea. So really, all you can do is try to follow the contour of the land. If you generally know where you are in relation to geographic features, you can just follow the contours. You know you came downhill, you'll go back uphill, that sort of thing. And it also helps to click the ever-useful return to start button or function on your Garmin, and it will pop up a little arrow that'll tell you whether you're headed towards home or away from home and what direction you're going. And it's very helpful when you are confronted with a choice of direction in the deep, dark woods. And we eventually found a trail after a bit and made our way home. And I did not end up getting a little poison ivy, but, it ended up being a pretty good midweek workout. I didn't get much training in while in the Netherlands this week, but it was good timing for a rest cycle. I had a very nice time. On the way back, I met up with Elma in Utrecht, and she pointed me to a nice loop around the little town of Benzdorp and let me play with her dogs, her lodger dogs, and then gave me a nice bicycle tour of Utrecht before packing me off into the train back to Amsterdam. So that was very nice. So now I'm off to party like it's 1899 with Jason down in St. Louis at the Mojo St. Loco this weekend. And then off to Houston at the crack of dawn on Monday. So I'm beginning to think I might be overscheduled. I did enjoy myself in Holland, even though those wooden shoes chafe a bit on the long runs. On with the show.
Take 2 steps towards the open field of space for which to lie. There's so much to this life, it sits hard within my mind. You've got to live life better than your parents ever tried. You sacrifice your time and then you sit back. And I hear you say, God damn, ain't this a beautiful world?
And now for the equipment check.
Mountain biking 101. I'm going to sum it up for you newbies, and I don't mean any offense for that. For the last couple of years, I've embarked on a mountain bike learning curve, and I did this voluntarily. I like to learn. I like to expect my learning to be reinforced, but I did not expect it to be reinforced with so much blood and so many contusions. But nevertheless, I have learned a great deal. And I'm going to give you my Reader's Digest version. Does that mean anything to anyone anymore, Reader's Digest? Does that even exist anymore? Okay, it's an old colloquialism from when we used to read. And we used to kill trees, grind them up, and print stuff on their guts with toxic inks made from mercury. Basically, it means summary. So I'm going to give you the summary. First, it's a little bit about the bike. Despite what Lance said, you need a functional mountain bike to even stand a chance. You can fake it on the road with an old 10-speed, but in the woods, you're toast if you don't have a functional bicycle. Mountain biking is a relatively new sport, and there have been rapid advances over the past few years in bike technology. You should be able to obtain a decent mountain bike as a beginner for $500 or so US. Now, I'm not going to go into the infinite complexity of a bicycle purchase. It's a bit like the what kind of running shoes should I get question, but it's very important to have a lightweight frame. If you're going to be dragging this machine up and down and in and out, it needs to be reasonably light. And you should get the front suspension. This allows the front end to compress when you hurtle with nauseating speed down hills over rocks and through muddy creeks. The front suspension keeps you from getting thrown into the trees. In the old days, you used to be able to only get 26-inch wheels. Now the 29-inch wheels are very popular. And I've ridden both, and I think the 29ers are much more forgiving for beginners. And they might be a bit heavier, but they have more stability, and they roll over obstacles much easier. And that being said, I'm on the larger end of the size scale, too, so the bigger bike works well with my frame. But I have gone too far already into the infinite and unanswerable bike question. So let's assume you get a decent bike and you're ready to venture out into the woods. Tip number one, middle. For the most part, unless you're on a hilly or technical course, you want to stay in the middle ring in the front and the middle ring in the cassette on the back and try to ride in that zone. You should only have to change the front ring up and down in the more extreme ascents or descents, and typically you control the ride with the rear cassette. Tip number two, careful with that front brake. Mountain bikes are configured differently than road bikes. You'll find that in a normal seated position, your weight is shifted forward over the front wheel, and if you pull on that front brake, you might go over the handlebars like Superman. Practice applying both brakes in a balanced way so that you can maintain control of the bike as you're braking. And it's a very common beginner scenario to launch yourself. Tip number three, on the downhills, get behind the seat. This is very important and will also prevent calamitous crashes. Since the mountain bike is weighted forward, you need to stand up on the pedals and move your center of gravity backwards on the downhills. Many times I will actually be crouched in the pedals with my hindquarters way behind the seat and low. In extreme situations, you may actually have your chest laying on the saddle on the seat. And sometimes on shallower hills, I'll grasp the back of the saddle between my thighs in a crouch. When you're going downhill, you're going to take the abuse with the front shocks, but also in your thighs as you're in this crouch. And you must unweight the front wheel, because if the front wheel jams into an obstacle while you're going downhill at 30 miles an hour, you are dead. Trust me. Tip number four, on the uphills, get up on the seat point. Mountain bikes are designed with very low gears that allow you to climb almost any hill. The problem is when you crank going up a steep hill, the front wheel wants to come up off the ground. You need to move your weight forward on the saddle so you're sitting squarely on the point of the saddle while you're cranking up the hill. Move your weight forward so you can maintain traction on the drive wheel while keeping the front wheel on the ground. Tip number five, look down the trail. Don't look at where you are now. There's nothing you can do about that. You need to look down the trail and see what's coming. Mountain biking is fairly fast, and you need to decide what you're going to do before you get there. Choose a line and stick with it. One of the big differences between trail running and mountain biking is that you have to look much farther down the trail and choose a line. Once you have chosen that line, you're committed, and you need to make the most of it. In mountain biking, much of your success or failure will rest on whether you choose a good line or not. And tip number six, keep pedaling. Seriously, it hurts to bail out on a mountain bike. First and foremost, your engine, your speed, and your power will save you. When you're halfway up through a deep puddle that comes up to your thighs, keep pedaling. When you're halfway through a precarious rock garden that's scaring the crap out of you, keep pedaling. And when you're halfway up that sketchy hill with lots of loose rocks, keep pedaling. Tip number seven, approach obstacles with controlled speed. A good amount of velocity cures many form problems. Slowing down makes everything hurt more. Pedal like a maniac when you see the big log or that big drop or that hairy-looking rock shelf coming. Before you know it, you'll be through and clear. If you go into it slow and tentative, you will crash. Well, that's it, folks. That's all I have for you. There are thousands of nuances and codicils for these tips, but that should be enough to get you out and riding. Don't be afraid. Mountain biking is not all crazy, death-defying stunts like you see on YouTube. It's a great workout and an awesome way to get some calories burned. And I'm the least coordinated person you'll ever meet, and I love it. Give it a try.
And now for our featured interview.
All right, so we're back, Drew.
Yes.
With me?
Yes, I'm with you.
Now we're recording. So where are you today?
Today I'm in Tucumcari, New Mexico.
Kidding.
I'm about 40 miles from the border of Texas on Route 54.
Did you ever hear the song Willin' by Lowell George?
No, I haven't.
He says, I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari. That's one of the lines.
Really?
Yeah, so you have to look that up.
I'll have to check
it.
Yeah, I have to put it on my iPod Shuffle now.
You know, I've talked to a lot of people who have run across the United States. You know, not a lot, more than two. And most people try to avoid being in the south part of the United States this time of year because it gets kind of hot there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it gets a little bit warm. But, you know, when I decided to do this, I initially decided that I was just going to leave my house in West Virginia and start running west, but I realized that I would be out here in July and August, and running through the desert in July and August I thought would be way worse than running through the desert in April, May, and a little bit of June.
Yeah, all right. Why don't you tell us who you are and what you're doing and why you're doing it?
My name's Drew Miller. I'm just your average Joe, basically. I'm 32 years old, and I'm from Spencer, West Virginia, and decided about October of last year that I was going to attempt to run across the United States. It's kind of a weird story as to how I got to it. I was always very athletic when I was younger, you know, played tons of sports, and all the way through high school and college, you know, I was in pretty good shape. And then suddenly, about age 25 or 26, I just started letting it go. And for the last 5 years or so, I've been pretty overweight and just out of shape and pretty much miserable physically. And I was sitting at the house watching ESPN 30 for 30 series, and they had the story on about Terry Fox. I'm sure people that are runners would know, you know, the name Terry Fox. I had no idea who he was. I'd never heard the story before, but what a story. And I'm sitting there watching this story about, you know, this guy with one leg and a prosthetic. I mean, you think of prosthesis or prosthetics back in 1980 versus today. I mean, my goodness, it was really, really old-fashioned stuff, so it couldn't have been very comfortable for the guy. I'm sitting there at 260 pounds. I'm basically a healthy human being, you know. I've never had any major issues health-wise. Sitting here watching this guy, you know, with one leg and recovering from cancer, and watch him struggle to get across Canada, and that immediately snapped me out of my little problem. Yeah, I suppose I could have just gone back to the gym. But it kind of stuck with me, though, when I saw that, and I thought, well, I wonder if I could do that. I wonder if I could do, like, a cross-country run. I wonder if that's possible for somebody like me. And just started talking with my family a little bit about it, and it just started to pick up some momentum. And by November, we started planning. We decided we were going to start this thing.
So how did the Wounded Warrior Project get rolled into this?
Well, you know, I knew once I decided I was going to do something this crazy, well, I consider it crazy. I mean, I'm not sure if the people out there are listening. I mean, apparently there's more people than I thought that think this is kind of a normal thing. Once I decided, you know, that I was actually going to do this, I thought, you know, what a great chance to try to raise some money. You know, if you're going to do something of this scale, then I got to use it as a platform to do something. And the military has always been very close to my heart. I come from a small town in West Virginia, and not that, you know, big cities aren't affected by it, but it seems to me that in the small towns, the communities are so close knit that even if it's not your family, it feels like your family that's affected by it. And, you know, I've got a couple of friends who have done a few different tours already over in Iraq and Afghanistan. My dad was in the military. My grandfather was in the military. You know, it's just one of those things that I've always been very passionate about.
Demographically, you are in the heart of military country because the kids in West Virginia, in Western Pennsylvania, in upstate New York, you know, in Maine, these are places where there isn't a whole bunch else to do, so they tend to end up in the military. But they also are really good at it. They've been born carrying guns and, you know, hunting and that sort of thing. So, you know, they make great soldiers. So you're right. A lot of the military comes from that part of the country.
Yeah, it really is. It's the truth about West Virginia for sure. And so, like I said, you know, it was immediate with me that I wanted to try to raise money for some cause. My mind immediately went to military, some kind of military organization. And I got a friend who lives, you know, probably about 10 miles from my hometown. It's still in the same county, but he was severely injured back, I think in 05 it was, I'm not sure. But he was severely injured in Iraq. And when he got back, he was helped by this organization a little bit. And he actually, in turn, since he's been out of, you know, active duty, he's done a few fundraisers for him. And so I immediately talked to him about it, and he said, yeah, they're a great organization, and he gave me all the contact information. So it was pretty much a no-brainer for me through him. And, you know, as I studied and looked through the Wounded Warrior Project, their organization has one of the best track records, you know, as a charitable organization for military.
Right. And basically their charter is to help wounded veterans.
Yeah, their primary goal is financial assistance, but also trying to get soldiers, when they come back after they've been severely wounded, try to get them reacclimated into everyday life. They'll take them on trips. They'll do hunting trips, fishing trips, you know, bike ride, all sorts of different things to get these guys back into just everyday society life.
Yep. So you decided to run from California to West Virginia?
Yeah, when we were kicking around the ideas of where we were going to go, you know, from where to where and how we were going to do it, we ended up settling on, instead of going through the northern route in the Rocky Mountains, which I really did not want to do those kind of mountains. Little did I know that through Arizona and New Mexico, it's like 8,000 feet elevation, too. I found that out about 4 or 5 weeks ago and couldn't avoid it anyway. So I went through mountainous region anyway, but we decided to go the low route and then up through Kansas and then through Kansas. I mean, it was basically the shortest route, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, we looked through it and I thought, well, I'm going to go from coast to Spencer, and what's the shortest route? And we went south and then up through where we're actually right now heading north into Kansas.
Right. Yep. You told me that you met some guy running in the other direction who was running across the United States, like purely by accident.
Purely by coincidence, and his name was Milton Miller. His last name was Miller as well. I swear to you, this is not a coincidence. I mean, it was crazy. I just finished a run up close to Bouse, Arizona. I think I got the name right there. But it was Route 72, I guess, would be the road. And I just finished my run, and we were driving into Bouse. I was just short of there. We were driving in there to an RV park, and as we're driving in, we passed this guy pushing a stroller in front of him heading west. And we had already read, of course, a couple of different people that were, you know, running across the country, and we talked about, well, a few of them are pushing strollers, so we thought, is this possible? So we turned around and stopped, and it, sure enough, Milton Miller was heading, his was called 100 Days of Madness, and he was going from Miami, Florida to Los Angeles. So, and at the time, he was only probably about a week and a half away from being finished.
Yeah, you got to start early because he's in Miami.
I mean, I've got a road crew, and I have a van to sleep in at worst. This guy went by himself, pushing a stroller in front of him, and he camped out in the desert by himself a lot. I mean, I'm sure he had some hostings. There's a lot of times he just set up tent and camped. I mean, that's majorly bold compared to what I'm doing.
He just decided to start running, huh? Yeah, that's crazy. I was looking at your blog. You've taken some great pictures. Seems like you're seeing a lot of interesting stuff. Anything stand out? Any good stories?
Pietown, New Mexico was great. It was awesome. They have a Pietown Realty, a Pietown Cemetery, and a Pietown Cafe, and that's about it. They got like 52 residents, I think, is their actual population. The town sits like right on the cusp of the Continental Divide. It's right before it, actually. Just a small town, and we met some really cool people there. I mean, they were all locals, other than the people coming through and stopping at the cafe. They actually sell pies there, which I was hoping was the case. But I met some really cool people, and just the people we've met along the way. It's really interesting how many people, when they read the signs on our van or something like that, or they happen to ask us where we're coming from, and then we tell them what we're doing, they always say, oh, I'm a veteran. I'm a former military. I've got a son who's in the military right now, or a daughter who's in the military. Just the conversations we've been able to strike up because of this, it's just been awesome.
So how many miles are you doing a day on average?
I do 20 miles a day, 4 days of running, and then I take a day off. Today is actually my day off, so I'm really enjoying just relaxing. But I do 20 miles a day, 4 days on, and 1 day off. I'm sitting right now at 980 miles, just finished up my 49th run yesterday. So I'm going to top the 1,000-mile barrier tomorrow. I'm excited about that.
Oh, that's great. The people I talk to about this say that typically in sometime early on, their body complains a little bit. They get some aches and pains, and then the body sort of figures it out after that. Is that what you found?
I'm still figuring it out, I think. I think my body's still trying to figure it out. Can't speak for, you know, anybody else that's doing, you know, a cross-country run, but I know just for me personally, I'm not what you would consider a runner. And I know when I met Milton, I mean, he and I both were basically couch potatoes. I weighed 262 pounds in January when I started training to do this. And I'd never run more than 5 miles in a day. Even after training for 3 months, the most I'd ever run in a day was 8 miles. So I got down to about 217 pounds by the time the run started. So, I mean, it's tough enough, I assume, for somebody who's like a marathon runner to run 20, 26 miles every day. So somebody that's got 217 pounds on their back, I mean, it was, to be honest with you, every 30 seconds for the first 2 weeks, I think I contemplated quitting. I mean, my body hurt that badly for the first 2 weeks. And after that, things started to just go numb, which was fine. I mean, as long as it didn't hurt, as long as they went numb. But I do feel in the last 2 weeks or so that my body is starting to really adjust to the daily grind, and I welcome it. It's been a nice change the last couple of weeks.
Have you seen some of the weight drop off? You seen your body reconfiguring itself as it figures out what you're doing?
It really is. I weighed myself in Phoenix, and I had dropped down to 200 pounds, and I haven't weighed myself since then, so we don't know where I am as far as weight. But, yeah, I mean, you can just look in the mirror, and I can, you know, feel it when I put clothes on, that everything's fitting a little looser now, so I can really see the change in my body. And that's what makes it extra exciting on a personal level for me is, you know, I wanted to do this run first off personally, and then I wanted to do it for a cause, but I still have in the back of my mind, this is a personal journey and this is a complete life change for me. And everybody that I talk to and a couple of the people that I've talked to that have done cross country runs say it's inevitable. It's a life changing experience. It will change your life. So personally, I'm excited about that, you know, physically, mentally, spiritually, you know, a complete overhaul basically of me.
Yep. So what are you going to do when you come out the other side of this? Any thoughts?
I have no idea, but it's really exciting. Got another couple months to think about it. Basically, I left my job, and luckily, I mean, this happened at the time that it did for me. Like I said, I've always wanted to do something crazy, and at 32, I don't have a wife, I don't have kids, I don't have a set career path, so this was basically, I think, my last opportunity to take a hold of something like this and do it. And I'm glad that I have. But once I get home, that's when I need to get back to business again. I just don't know what the business is going to be.
Yeah, but you'll at least have this under your belt.
I never know what's going to happen from this. You know, I just don't know. I mean, maybe some contact from this trip will spark something. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Sky's the limit. So what have you learned? What are the, you know, top three things that you learned from this, that especially those things that surprised you?
For one, I learned that even as hard as I thought this would be, it is 15 to 20 times harder than that. You know, in your mind, you think, oh, this is going to be really tough, but I don't think you can ever actually understand how hard it is until you do it. It's been a real, like, shock to me is how hard this is, both mentally and physically, on your body. The thing that's great about this that I've learned is that what I thought were my limits are just kind of more or less mental guidelines that I've set for myself that I've been breaking through over and over daily. You know, I'm still constantly amazed and surprised and humbled with my own body's ability. You know, I think I've really surprised myself with the limits that I can push beyond. And that's exciting to me. You know, that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, your body's an amazing machine, isn't it?
It really is. It's an amazing thing. And it's unfortunate, I wrote in one of my blogs, it's unfortunate that the 5 or 6 years that I basically wasted physically, I'll never, ever get back. And those were some good years. You think about your body from age 24, 25 years old to 30. I mean, those are some really prime years that you could get some really good use out of that I'll never get back. But the best thing I can do now is go ahead and get this done and get back what I can. And then from now on, you know, treat my body with a little more respect.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I wouldn't worry. I wouldn't waste a lot of time looking backwards. You know, you've done a great thing to pick up your feet and just get out there. And I think you're going to find that the world will open up for you while you're out there. So you say you're single, right? So this would be a great opportunity for you to meet some women, too. You're getting out there
on
the road.
Yeah. I'm taking a little bit of opportunity when I'm not huffing and puffing on the road. When I got days off, I mean, I make sure to take time to look around and see some of the sights, if you will. But, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely available.
If people want to make a donation to your cause, what are the links? How do they find out what you're doing?
As simple as I could make it, go to my blog site, which is dmrun.blogspot.com, And right on the right side of the page is like, as soon as you open it up, on the right side of the page, there's a link that says online donations page. And that's the one great thing about the Wounded Warrior Project. They have their own link to donations through Kintera, and they track all of my donations for me. They keep an updated list. They have all my reports, which is just wonderful. All I have to do is send people to my site, and then they can donate online from there. If they don't feel comfortable donating online, they can print off a form and send a check to the Wounded Warrior Project with the form, and then the Wounded Warrior Project in turn will give me credit on my event. So it's just it's very simple for me, and hopefully it's simple for everybody who's wanting to donate.
All right, so that's using David, M as in Mary, and run, all one word, .blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. And
yep.
It's been great talking
yep.
to you. I'm going to let you go, let you get on with your day off.
Hey, Chris, I really appreciate the interview, man.
All right, no worries. You have fun. I'm jealous. I'm jealous as hell.
Come on out and run with me anytime.
All right, we'll see you.
Okay, see you, Chris.
Bye-bye.
Here's today's quick tips.
Trails 101. What is a trail? Before I start telling you all about how to enjoy running trails, I think I had better answer the question, what the heck is a trail anyhow? And I realize that some of the things I say and talk about when I discourse on trail running may not make any sense, unless you can put yourself in and appreciate the environment that I'm experiencing. My typical trail is an unpaved farm road that was cut into the forest 100 years ago, before it was a forest. The road was cut without the assistance of surveyors and modern earth-moving equipment, and these roads, coombe trails, follow the contour of the land. They meander along the tops of rocky ridges to avoid ponds and swamps. They cut up and down rolling hills following the natural lines, and they end up at stream crossings where the rivers are shallow for ease of fording, or at narrow points where a bridge of logs or rocks can be thrown across. In my trails here in New England, the forests have grown back and closed densely and closely in on the trail. Wild rose bushes and raspberry canes lean into the trail, throwing exploratory vines into the gaps that tear at and garrote the inattentive runner. The trail surface is pine needles and packed mulched leaves. The old roads are 3 or 4 feet wide with two wheeled grooves still straddling a centerline raised peak. Random large and small rocks push their way up through the wheel tracks, exposing obstacles of all shapes, sizes, and distribution. And these rocks are mostly half exposed and rounded from the action of the glaciers that left them there. When it rains and during the spring melt, the depressed concavity of the old wheel tracks fill with puddles and mud, and the roots of trees are exposed and run at crazy angles to the trail, spiderwebbing away from the trees that grow on the edges. The trees themselves are 40 to 50 years old and close in on the trail completely with a dense canopy 80 to 100 feet tall. On the forest floor, all manner of bushes and immature trees compete for the filtered light in a mad scramble of underbrush. Most of the woods I run in used to be farmers' fields. Old stone walls run in delineating patterns all around and across the trails in places. These walls are not structured with mortar. They have been sitting unattended for over 100 years and are basically long, straight rock piles, and they are just wonderful. That is what I mean when I say I went trail running. So what do your trails look like? As it turns out, several of the organizations that use trails have rating systems. These typical rating systems are a 1-to-5 scale, with 1 being easy and 5 being hardest, and what they rate is the characteristics that make a trail difficult for hiking, running, or riding. And the first thing they rate is the surface. And this may be the most important for you. Some trails at the easiest end of the spectrum are paved. They're basically roads without cars on them, like many of our converted rail trails and bike trails. And they're basically little roads in the woods or out on the road there. The next level of difficulty is dirt roads, which are still quite forgiving of a surface. I would argue that a well-groomed and packed dirt surface is quite good for fast times. I qualified for Boston on a rail trail course just like this once. And as you progress up the difficulty scale, you encounter various levels of rocks and roots and sand and mud and all manner of nasty and difficult surfaces. The second thing that they rate on trails is the width of the trail. And when you hear us refer to single path, that means the trail's only wide enough for one individual at a time. And the old farm roads that I run would technically be double path. That's how wide they are. One of the common descriptions you hear is fire roads. And these are roads that were cut into the forest so that in the event of a forest fire, the equipment can get in. And it forces the fire to have to jump over the road, creating a bit of a fire barrier. And sometimes these are well-groomed dirt roads, and sometimes they are not so well-maintained. The ultra-distance trail races that I have ridden and run have a fairly large percentage of these courses on dirt roads and fire roads, with technical bits interspersed. And by the way, when we say technical, we mean difficult. My point is that you shouldn't train with the expectation that the race is going to be entirely technical trails for the whole time, or one type of trail. Typically, the longer races will have different sections of varying difficulty. And the other characteristic of difficulty that they rate when describing trails is elevation, of course. Very mountainous, steep uphill, steep downhill sections are more difficult than running on a flat road. The steep bits tend to have more challenging surface conditions due to washouts and slides and other conditions. And sometimes trail running systems will speak to the number of obstacles on the trail, like things you have to climb over or through. And some will consider the number and difficulty of water crossings. And those are the fun trails. Finally, you might want to consider exposure on the trail you're running or planning to run. My trails are quite protected by the trees. I don't have to worry about the glaring sun of the desert or the whipping wind of a highland ridgeline. But I don't know about your trail where you live. That's what we mean when we smile and say the course is a bit technical. You want to consider this when you're just starting out running trails. An example would be that 18-mile Wapak trail race that my club organizes. If you consider the distance, you might think that this is a nice little 18-mile training run for your next marathon. This course is quite difficult. That doesn't mean it isn't fun, it's just difficult. It's mostly single path over broken rock fields and traverses four mountains twice. So what does that mean for your 18-mile training run? Well, taking me as an example, probably not a good example, I would run an 18-mile training run out on the road somewhere in the 2.5-hour range. And I'm an experienced trail runner. I know this course well. It takes me just under 3.5 hours on a good day to complete this race. That's a full 50% longer at the same or harder effort level. So that'll give you an idea of the scale of a technical course. So make sure you ease into it and know what you're getting into. A race like the Wapak can beat the hell out of you, but it's also one of my favorite races because it's just a big ball of fun for me. To be out in the woods, flying down a rocky mountain ledge, down the side of a mountain, swinging from trees and jumping from rock to rock, it just doesn't get any better than that. Okay, my friends, that is it. You have gotten your passport stamped by a humorless immigration agent, progressed through the long security lines, and find yourself at the departure gate of yet another Run, Run, Live podcast, episode 178, in the can. Next week, I think we'll talk to with the coach again, Coach Jeff, about some training points and see if we can bring some lucidity, some additional clarity to some things. I'm queued up for St. Louis this weekend, where the breaking news is that the mighty Missouri River, I guess it's both in St. Louis, but the Missouri River is flooded. It's cresting. It's over the levees, and the trail where we were going to run is underwater, similar to most of the stock options I've owned in my life. Not to be deterred, Jason has created a new and even better course around St. Louis, and I'll be heading down Friday. Since I'm the only Mojo Loco alumni in attendance, I'll try to capture lots of sights and sounds for y'all and push them out to the social verse. I'm still training, rather casually, for one more sprint triathlon, the Wilderness 101 Ultra Mountain Bike Race, and the Vermont 50-50 Mile Ultra Marathon. It's really just a lot of miles and time on my feet. I do what I can during the week, and I go long on the bike typically Saturday morning, and then long on my feet on Sunday morning. And it ends up being a lot of miles, but low impact, low stress. I get to think a lot and burn a lot of calories. It's good. I'm holding up fairly well. I have some tennis elbow from swimming too hard. Since I'm only doing one pool workout a week, it's typically fairly long and fairly hard. See now I know you're thinking that you're thinking of one of those "that's what she said" jokes, right? I have also had a sore heel for the last couple of weeks, and I'm not sure what it is yet. I think it may be that my launches are totally worn out, or I'm just doing too much and my Achilles is complaining, but I'll figure it out. I'm also doing a modified 100 push-ups type routine three times a week, or I'm trying to. I've started this. I'm doing push-ups, crunches, calf raises, and squats. And I think these should focus on the muscles that I need for the big mountain bike race. Last year, I suffered far too much because I just was not fit enough in my core in certain places to work the bike for that hellish 12 hours. I read a chapter today in the Thomas DeLonge book, Flying Without a Net, that I'm reading. And this morning in the departure lounge, it hit me, and this bit resonated with me. It was about the curse of busyness. He was talking about the curses of these type of people, professionals, and of how we as professionals get to the point where we're so busy, we cease to add value. And the irony is that we are addicted to the busyness precisely because it makes us feel like we're doing something, we're adding value. And we have this need to feel significant in our roles. And acting busy, doing things, and lots of them, fills this need for significance. And of course, we are significant. Of course we're adding value. It took us 3 hours to triage the 100 email messages last night in our inbox. We had to come in early. We had to stay late. We had to take 5 connecting flights and speak to 10 clients in 3 countries in 4 days last week. Of course we're adding value. But how much of this is actually adding value? How much introspection are we actually doing? How much of these activities are aligned with what adds value to us as individuals, to the company, to our families, to our community? And how much of it is just a mask, a smokescreen, to avoid confronting ourselves and finding something truly valuable to do, and perhaps making ourselves feel a tad bit uncomfortable and vulnerable in the process, but maybe growing? Are you one of those people? Are you that guy or gal that must constantly do email at your kid's ball game because you might miss something and slip into insignificance? Well, guess what? You're missing the ball game. So watch the game, and I'll see you out there. My friends, the president called me personally and told me to tell you to friend me on Twitter, Facebook, Daily Mile, and YouTube as CYKT Russell. That's Chris Yellow, King Tom Russell, with 2 S's and 2 L's. And of course, he got in touch with me by calling 206-339-7804. Leave a message there, and it sends me an audio file. There are a couple thousand close friends out there who want to meet you. They want to know about your blog or your favorite race. So call in and do the show intro. You'll find the instructions for reading the show intro and all my content on my website, www.runrunlive.com. Music tonight is a classic blues rock number by Don't Harass Betty called Your Love Is Everything. Ciao.
podcast for all your running needs.